I've loved, every love I've lost, every place I've been, every conversation I've had, every book I've read and song I've sung, everything, everything crumbling and mixing and decomposing underneath. Nothing wasted. My entire past there, holding me up and feeding me now. All of this too low for anyone else to see, just there for me to draw from. Then up and up, all the way to my branches, my imagination, too high for anyone else to see, reaching beyond, growing toward the light and warmth. Then the middle, the trunk, the only part of me entirely visible to the world, pulpy and soft inside, just tough enough on the outside to protect and hold me, exposed and safe. I am as ancient as the earth I'm planted in and as new as my tiniest bloom. I am my own touch tree, strong, singular, alive, still growing. I have everything I need beneath me, above me, inside me. I am never gonna lose me. Buckets. Just as I was about to fall asleep the other night, I heard a faint knock on my bedroom door. "Come in," I said. Tish walked into my room and stopped at my bedside, watery-eyed, apologetic. "What's wrong, baby?" "I'm scared." "Of what?" "Everything. But nothing. It's not that anything's wrong, really. It's just I'm all by myself in here, in my body. I'm just lonely or something. I forget during the day when I'm busy, but at night, in bed, I remember. I'm all alone in here. It's scary." Tish climbed into bed. We laid our heads on one pillow and looked directly into each other's eyes. We were searching, trying to find ourselves in each other, trying to blur the lines between us. We've been trying to blur them since the doctor first put Tish into my arms, and I said, "Hi, Angel." Since I first leaned over and tried to breathe her into my own lungs. Since I first put my mouth next to hers and tried to swallow her sweet, warm breath and make it mine. Since my molars would ache when I played with her toes and I'd understand why some animals eat their young. Tish and I have been trying to collapse the gap her birth created between us since we turned from one body into two. But our separation keeps getting wider with each step, each word, each passing year. Slipping, slipping. "Hold my hand, honey. Come in. I'm scared, Mommy." I brushed a strand of her hair from her cheek and whispered, "I feel lonely in this skin, too. Remember when we were at the beach today and we were watching that little girl wade into the waves and collect seawater in her little plastic buckets? Sometimes I feel like I'm one of those buckets of sea next to other buckets of sea. Wishing we could pour into each other, mix together somehow so we're not so separate. But we always have these buckets between us." Tish has always understood metaphors best. That thing you feel but can't see, baby, it's like that thing you can see. She listened as I told her about the buckets and her gold-brown canyon eyes widened. She whispered back, "Yeah, it's like that." I told her that maybe when we were born, we were poured from our source into these tiny body buckets. When we die, we'll be emptied back out and returned to that big source into each other. Maybe dying is just returning back out from these tiny containers to where we belong. Maybe then all the achy separation we feel down here will disappear because we'll be mixed together again. No difference between you and me. No more buckets. No more skin. I'll see. But for now, I told her, you are a bucket of sea. That's why you feel so big and so small. She smiled, fell asleep. I watched her for a bit and whispered a little prayer into her ear. You are not the bucket. You are the sea. Stay fluid, baby. Attendance. One morning, in the middle of the divorce, I called Liz to ask for parenting advice. Liz doesn't have children, so she is still sane enough to have perspective. I said, I know that all is well and everything is fine at the deepest level and all that shit. I know all of that, but I don't know it today. I'm worried that I ruined them. They're confused and afraid, and for Christ's sake, this is the one thing I swore I'd never do to them. She said, "Okay, Glennon, here is what I see happening. Your family is together on an airplane right now. You are the flight attendant, and the kids are passengers on their first flight. The plane just hit some serious turbulence, and the airplane is bouncing." "Yes," I said, "that sounds about right." "Okay, what do passengers do when turbulence hits?" "They look at the flight attendant. If the flight attendant appears to be panicked, the passengers panic. If the flight attendants are calm and steady, the passengers feel safe and follow suit." "Glennon, you've been flying and living long enough to know that while turbulence feels scary, it won't take the plane down. Turbulence isn't deadly, and neither is divorce. We survive these things. The kids don't know this yet, so they are afraid. They are going to keep looking at your face for information. Your job right now is to smile at them, stay calm, and keep serving the freaking peanuts." This is what I told myself every single day during the divorce and a million times since. Keep serving the freaking peanuts, Glennon. I was talking to a friend about this parenting mantra, and she said, "Yes, turbulence doesn't take planes down, but planes do crash. What if the thing that's shaking your family's plane is real? What if your family actually is going down?" A friend of a friend found out a year ago that her teenage daughter was dying of cancer. That's not turbulence. That's the crash we all fear. That's a family going down with the full knowledge that they won't all make it out alive. This woman started drinking and drugging, and she didn't stop, so her daughter died while she was high. Her other two daughters watched their sister die without their mama present because she had jumped ship. I think about this mother every day. I feel deep empathy for her. I also feel afraid for her. I fear that one day she will finally get still, and that stillness will be so full of scalding regret that it will be impossible to stay. We don't control the turbulence or tragedy that happens to our families. The plot of our lives is largely out of our control. We decide only the response of the main character. We decide whether we will be the one who jumps ship or the one who stays and leads. Parenthood is serving the peanuts amid turbulence. Then, when real trouble hits, when life brings our family death, divorce, bankruptcy, illness, parenthood is looking at little faces and knowing that we are as afraid as they are. Parenthood is thinking, "This is too much. I cannot lead them, but I will do the thing I cannot do." So we sit down next to our babies. We turn their faces toward ours until they are looking away from the chaos and directly into our eyes. We take their hands in ours. We say to them, "Look at me. It's you and me. I am here. This is more real than anything out there. You and me." We will hold hands and breathe and love each other, even if we are falling from the sky. Family is, whether we're falling or flying, we're going to take care of each other through the whole damn ride. Memos. Every generation of parents receives a memo when they leave the hospital with their baby. My grandmother's memo: "Here is the baby. Take it home and let it grow. Let it speak when spoken to. Carry on with your lives." My mother's memo: "Here is your baby. Take her home and then get together each day with your friends who also have these things. Drink tab before 4 o'clock and wine coolers after. Smoke cigarettes and play cards. Lock the kids out of the house and let them in only to eat and sleep." Lucky bastards. Our memo: "Here is your baby. This is the moment you have been waiting for your entire life, when the hole in your heart is filled and you finally become complete. If, after I put this child in your arms, you sense anything other than utter fulfillment, seek counseling immediately. After you hang up with the counselor, call a tutor. Since we have been speaking for 3 minutes, your child is already behind. Have you registered her for Mandarin classes yet?" "I see. Poor child." "Listen closely. Parent is no longer a noun. Those days are gone. Parent is now a verb, something you do ceaselessly. Think of the verb parent as synonymous with protect, shield, hover, deflect, fix, plan, and obsess. Parenting will require all of you. Please parent with your mind, body, and soul. Parenting is your new religion within which you will find salvation. This child is your savior. Convert or be damned. We will wait while you cancel all other life endeavors. Thank you. Now, the goal of parenting is never allow anything difficult to happen to your child. To that end, she must win every competition she enters. Here are your 400 participation trophies. Distribute accordingly. She must feel that everyone likes and loves her and wants to be with her at all times. She must be constantly entertained and amused. Every one of her days on Earth must be like Disneyland, but better. If you go to actual Disneyland, get a fast pass, because she should never be forced to wait for anything, ever. If other kids don't want to play with her, call those kids' parents, find out why, and insist they fix it. In public, walk in front of your child and shield her from any unhappy faces that might make her sad and any happy faces that might make her feel left out. When she gets into trouble at school, call her teacher and explain loudly that your child does not make mistakes. Insist that the teacher apologize for her mistake. Do not ever, ever let a drop of rain fall upon your child's fragile head. Raise this human without ever allowing her to feel a single uncomfortable human emotion. Give her a life without allowing life to happen to her. In short, your life is over, and your new existence is about ensuring that her life never begins. Godspeed. We got a terrible memo. Our terrible memo is why we are exhausted, neurotic, and guilty. Our terrible memo is also why our kids suck. They do. They just suck. Because people who do not suck are people who have failed, dusted themselves off, and tried again. People who do not suck are people who have been hurt, so they have empathy for others who are hurt. People who do not suck are those who have learned from their own mistakes by dealing with the consequences. People who do not suck are people who have learned how to win with humility and how to lose with dignity. Our memo has led us to steal from our children the one thing that will allow them to become strong people: struggle. Our terrible memo is also why we stay busy with the trivial while the world our children will inherit crumbles. We obsess over our children's snacks while they rehearse their own deaths in active shooter drills at school. We agonize over their college prep while the earth melts around them. I cannot imagine that there has ever been a more overparented and underprotected generation. New memo. Here is your baby. Love her at home, at the polls, in the streets. Let everything happen to her. Be near. Poems. When Chase was little, we'd find him at our kitchen table drawing maps of the world and making lists of every country on Earth and its capital. He'd pass entire afternoons writing his own song lyrics, and we'd collect little poems he left all over the house. When he turned 13, we bought him a cell phone because he desperately wanted one and we wanted to make him happy. Slowly, we watched him fade away. He stopped drawing maps and reading and writing, and we stopped finding poems around the house. When he was with us, I could sense his need to be there instead. So even when he wasn't on his phone, he was gone. He was just hovering among us. His eyes changed. They became a little duller and heavier. They'd been the brightest eyes I'd ever seen, and then one day they just weren't. In his phone, Chase had found a place easier to exist in than inside his own skin. That was tragic because inside the itchiness of our own skin is where we discover who we are. When we are bored, we ask ourselves, what do I want to do with myself? We are guided towards certain things, a pen and paper, a guitar, the forest in the backyard, a soccer ball, a spatula. The moment after we don't know what to do with ourselves is the moment we find ourselves. Right after itchy boredom is self-discovery. But we have to hang in there long enough without bailing. There's so much about phones and children that parents worry about. We worry that we are raising children with commodified views of sex, lack of real connection, filtered concepts of what it means to be human. But I find myself worrying most that when we hand our children phones, we steal their boredom from them. As a result, we are raising a generation of writers who will never start writing, artists who will never start doodling, chefs who will never make a mess of the kitchen, athletes who will never kick a ball against a wall, musicians who will never pick up their aunt's guitar and start strumming. I was once talking to a Silicon Valley executive who had played an integral role in the creation and proliferation of cell phones. I asked how old her kids had been when she'd bought them phones. She laughed and said, "Oh, my kids don't have phones." "Ah," I said, "don't get your kids high on your own supply." Those who made the phones are creative people, and they want their children to become people who create, not just consume. They don't want their children searching for themselves out there. They want them discovering themselves in here. They know that phones were designed to keep us addicted to exterior life, and that if we never dive inward, we never become who we were meant to be. Abby and Craig and I talked about Chase's slow fade incessantly, but we didn't do anything about it. I knew in my gut that Chase was becoming addicted to his phone and that this was interrupting his growth and peace. But I was afraid that if I took the phone, he'd be left behind and left out. He'd be so different from the others. It took me 2 more years to remember that fear of being different is a terrible reason for a parent to avoid doing what her child needs her to do. When Chase was a freshman in high school, I asked him to take a walk with me. As we made our way down our driveway and to the sidewalk, I turned to my bright, beautiful boy and said, "I make a lot of mistakes parenting you, but I only know they are mistakes in retrospect. I've never made a decision for you that I know in real time is wrong for you. Until now. I know I'm not doing right by letting you keep that phone in your life. I know that if I took it away, you'd be more content again. You'd be present. You might have less contact with all your peers, but you'd have more real connections with your friends. You'd probably start reading again, and you'd live inside that beautiful brain and heart of yours instead of the cyber world. We'd waste less of our precious time together. I know this. I know what I need to do for you, and I'm not doing it. I think it's because all of your friends have phones, and I don't want you to have to be different." But everybody's doing it reason. But then I think about how it's not all that unusual for everybody to be doing something that we later find out is addictive and deadly. Like smoking. Everybody was doing that a couple decades ago. Chase was quiet for a while. We kept walking. Then he said, "I read this thing that said that kids are getting more depressed and stressed than ever because of phones. It also said we can't talk to each other as well. I notice those things about myself sometimes lately. I also read that Ed Sheeran gave up his phone." "Why do you imagine he did that?" "He said he wants to create things instead of looking at things other people create. And he wants to see the world through his own eyes instead of through a screen. I think I'd probably be happier without my phone. Sometimes I feel like I have to check it, like it controls me. It's like a job I don't want or get paid for or anything. It feels stressful sometimes." "Okay," I said. Chase and Tish both decided to quit social media and use their phones only for texting. We're going to wait until high school to get Emma a phone. We do not want to give her a job while she's so young. We want to give her the gift of boredom so she can discover who she is before she learns what the world wants her to be. We've decided that our job as her parents is not to keep her happy. Our job is to keep her human. This is not a story about phones. This is a story about knowing. Brave parenting is listening to the knowing, ours and our children's. It's doing what's true and beautiful for our child, no matter how countercultural it seems. It's about how when we know what our children need, we don't pretend not to know. Boys. I have been raising my daughters to be feminists since they were in utero. I knew the world's training would begin the second they were born, and I wanted them to be ready. Ready meant having an internal narrative about what it means to be a woman that they could weigh against the world's narrative. I did not have an alternative narrative as a child. So when the world told me that a real girl is small, quiet, pretty, accommodating, and pleasant, I believed that this was the truth. I breathed in those lies, and they made me very sick. Children are either taught by the adults in their lives to see cages and resist them, or they are trained by our culture to surrender to them. Girls born into a patriarchal society become either shrewd or sick. It's one or the other. I wanted my girls to know this. You are a human being, and your birthright is to remain fully human. So you get to be everything: loud, quiet, bold, smart, careful, impulsive, creative, joyful, big, angry, curious, ravenous, ambitious. You are allowed to take up space on this earth with your feelings, your ideas, your body. You do not need to shrink. You do not need to hide any part of yourself ever. It's a lifelong battle for a woman to stay whole and free in a world hell-bent on caging her. I wanted to give my girls whatever they'd need to fight for their full humanity. Truth is the only weapon that can beat the pervasive lies the world will tell them. So I'd place headphones over my watermelon belly at night and play audiobooks about brave, complicated women. After they were born, I'd rock my daughters to sleep with stories about women who had broken out of their culture's cages to live free and offer their gifts to the world. As they grew, we'd go for walks and guess the careers of the women passing by. I bet she's an engineer, a CEO, an Olympic athlete. When another mother jokingly mentioned my daughter's bossiness, I'd say, "Isn't it great? She's a leader." When my girls lost a game and became furious, I'd say, "It's okay to be angry." When they started school and began to consider dimming and shrinking themselves, I'd say, "Keep raising your hand, honey. You can be your bold, brilliant self out there in the world. You can be sure of yourself and still be a girl." It worked. As they grew, they'd come home from school and ask why the winner on the four-square court was always called king. They'd ask their teachers why all the language in the Constitution was he. They insisted that we transfer from their Christian elementary school because the teacher refused to entertain the idea of referring to God as she. When Tisha's soccer jersey was issued to her with Lady Bruins on it, she led a revolt, demanding that either the lady be removed from the girls' jerseys or gentlemen be added to the boys' jerseys. Emma wore suits to school, and when classmates called her a boy, she shrugged. When I complained about missing my appointment to dye my gray roots, Tisha asked, "Why are you trying to change who you are?" 5 years ago, I was cleaning up the kitchen while CNN droned on. I walked over to flip the channel, but then I noticed a particular and disturbing pattern in the reporting. The first story was about several white male government officials who had been caught lying and cheating to keep their power. The second story included footage of a police officer brutally beating an unarmed black teenager. Then, these stories. A 15-year-old school shooter who killed three classmates, one of whom was a girl who had rejected his advances. Members of a lacrosse team had been charged with gang rape. A college boy had been killed in a hazing incident. A middle school gay boy had hung himself because of bullying at school. A 35-year-old decorated veteran had just succumbed to PTSD. I stared open-mouthed at the TV and thought, "Oh my God, this is what it looks like for boys to try to comply with our culture's directions. They are not allowed to be whole either. Boys are in cages too. Boys who believe that real men are all powerful will cheat and lie and steal to claim and keep power. Boys who believe that girls exist to validate them will take a woman's rejection as a personal affront to their masculinity. Boys who believe that open, vulnerable connection between men is shameful will violently hate gay boys. Boys who believe that men don't cry will become men who rage. Boys who learn that pain is weakness will die before they ask for help. Being an American boy is a setup. We train boys to believe that the way to become a man is to objectify and conquer women, value wealth and power above all, and suppress any emotions other than competitiveness and rage. Then we are stunned when our boys become exactly what we have trained them to be. Our boys cannot follow our directions, but they are cheating and dying and killing as they try to. Everything that makes a boy human is a real man's dirty secret. Our men are caged too. The parts of themselves they must hide to fit into those cages are the slices of their humanity that our culture has labeled feminine. Traits like mercy, tenderness, softness, quietness, kindness, humility, uncertainty, empathy, connection. We tell them, don't be these things because these are feminine things to be. Be anything but feminine. The problem is that the parts of themselves that our boys have been banished from are not feminine traits. They are human traits. There is no such thing as a feminine quality because there is no such thing as masculinity or femininity. Femininity is just a set of human characteristics a culture pours into a bucket and slaps with the label feminine. Gender is not wild, it's prescribed. When we say girls are nurturing and boys are ambitious, girls are soft and boys are tough, girls are emotional and boys are stoic, we are not telling truths. We are sharing beliefs, beliefs that have become mandates. If these statements seem true, it's because everyone has been so well programmed. Human qualities are not gendered. What is gendered is permission to express certain traits. Why? Why would our culture prescribe such strict gender roles? And why would it be so important for our culture to label all tenderness and mercy as feminine? Because disallowing the expression and valuation of these qualities is the way the status quo keeps its power. In a culture as imbalanced as ours, in which a few hoard billions while others starve, in which wars are fought for oil, in which children are shot and killed while gun manufacturers and politicians collect the blood money, mercy, humanity, and vulnerability cannot be tolerated. Mercy and empathy are great threats to an unjust society. So how does power squash the expression of these traits? In a misogynistic culture, all that is needed is to label them feminine. Then we can forever discount them in women and forever shame them out of men. Ta-da! No more messy, world-changing tenderness to deal with. We can continue on without our shared humanity challenging the status quo in any way. I stood and stared at the TV set. I thought back on how I had prepared my girls from day one to fight for their humanity. I thought, fuck, I have a son too. I do not recall rocking my son to sleep with stories about tender men. I do not remember pointing to men passing by, I bet he's a poet, a teacher, a devoted father. When an adult mentioned my son's sensitivity, I don't remember saying, isn't it great? His tenderness is his strength. When he started school, I do not recall saying, you can be quiet, sad, merciful, small, vulnerable, loving, and kind out there in the world. You can be unsure of yourself and still be a boy. I do not remember saying to him, girls are not for conquering. They do not exist to play supporting roles in the stories of men. They exist all on their own. I want my son to keep his humanity. I want him to stay whole. I do not want him to become sick. I want him to be shrewd. I do not want him to surrender to cages he must slowly die inside or kill his way out of. I do not want him to become another unconscious brick that power uses to build fortresses around itself. I want him to know the true story, which is that he is free to be fully human forever. My son is an accomplished student athlete. He takes tough classes, stays up all hours of the night studying, then wakes up early to go to practice. Until a few months ago, I used that as an excuse to let him slack off at home. I straightened his room for him while he was at school, I did his laundry, and I cleaned up the nightly mess he left out in the family room. One evening, he asked to skip the dishes to go finish his homework. I let him go while Abby, the girls, and I finished up. That night in bed, Abby said, "Babe, I know it's out of love, but you cater to Chase, and he takes advantage of it." I said, "That's ridiculous." And then I lay in bed and stared at the ceiling for an hour. The next day, I turned on the TV and saw a commercial about a couple who had just become parents. The young mother left the baby with his father to return to work for the first time. The camera followed the father around the house as their Alexa chirped constant reminders that the mother had programmed the night before. Don't forget music class at 9. Don't forget lunch at noon. The bottle's in the fridge. You're doing a great job. Viewers were meant to swoon at the sweetness. All I could think was, did this father just arrive on Earth? Is he new here? Why does he need minute-by-minute coaching in order to care for his baby? What did preparation for this day look like for this baby's mother? In addition to getting ready to go back to work, this mama spent the previous night thinking through every minute of her husband's next day. She anticipated each of his and his baby's needs, and then she trained Alexa to hold the father's hand all day so he did not have to think at all. But this father appeared to be a grown man who loved his son. There was no earthly reason why he would not be every bit as capable of caring for his son as his wife was. They were both new parents. How had one of them become so helpless? Oh, I thought. Oh. The next day, I left Chase a list of chores to do. He didn't finish them. When I confronted him, he said, "I'm so sorry, Mom. I've got this big physics test tomorrow." I said, "No, I'm sorry, Chase. I've been sending you the wrong message. I have accidentally taught you that achieving out there is more important than serving your family in here. I've taught you that home is where you spend your leftover energy. Out there is where you give your best. I need to course correct by giving you this bottom line. I don't give a rat's ass how much respect you earn for yourself out in the world if you are not showing respect to the people inside your home. If you don't get that right, nothing you do out there will matter much. Our boys are born with great potential for nurturing, caring, loving, and serving. Let's stop training it out of them." Years ago, my ex-husband went out to dinner with an old friend who'd just had a baby. They stayed out for hours, and when Craig got home, I said, "Tell me everything. What's the baby's name?" Craig said, "I don't know." I said, "What? Okay. How's it going at home? Are they exhausted? Is the baby sleeping? How's Kim doing with it all?" I didn't ask. "Okay. How's his mother? Is the cancer getting worse?" He didn't mention it. "Wait, what did you talk about for 2 hours?" "I don't know. Work? Soccer?" I remember looking at Craig and thinking, I wouldn't trade places with him for all the money in the world. I would not have made it through early parenting without honest friends to talk through how hard it all was. It must be so lonely to be a man. It must be so difficult to carry by yourself all the things we were meant to help each other carry. I don't want my son to be tamed into loneliness. So when I get stuck carpooling Chase and his friends all over God's green earth, I turn down the radio and say, "What was your most embarrassing moment this week? What's your favorite thing about Jeff, Juan, Chase? Hey, guys, who do you imagine is the loneliest kid in your class? How do you feel during those active shooter drills when you're hiding in the closet with your friends?" In the rearview mirror, I catch them rolling their eyes at each other. Then they start talking, and I marvel at how interesting their inner thoughts, feelings, and ideas are. I remember once one of the boys said something particularly vulnerable, and the other boys giggled uncomfortably. I said, "Hey, just remember that when you laugh at something someone has said, it's not about the person who spoke. It's about you. He was brave enough to be honest. You be brave enough to handle it. Life is hard. Friends need to be safe places for each other. Our boys are just as human as our girls are. They need permission, opportunities, and safe places to share their humanity. Let's encourage real, vulnerable conversations among our sons and their friends. Let's ask about their feelings, relationships, hopes, and dreams so they don't become middle-aged men who feel permitted to discuss only sports, sex, news, and the weather. Let's help our boys become adults who don't have to carry life alone." My friend Jason told me that for the entirety of his childhood, he had cried only in the bathroom because his tears would bother his father and mother. "Man up," they'd say. He told me that he and his wife, Natasha, were trying to raise their son differently. They want Tyler to be able to express all of his emotions safely, so Jason has been modeling vulnerability by expressing himself more openly in front of his son and his wife. After he told me that, he said, "This might be in my head, but I feel like when I try to get vulnerable, Natasha gets uncomfortable. She says she wants me to be sensitive, but the two times I've cried in front of her or admitted that I was afraid, I felt her pull back." Natasha is my dear friend, so I asked her about that. When I told her what Jason had said, she looked surprised. "I can't believe he noticed that. But he's right. When he cries, I feel weird. I'm embarrassed to say that what I feel is kind of like disgust." Last month, he admitted that he was afraid about money. I told him we would get through it together, but on the inside, I felt myself thinking, "Man up, dude. Man up? I'm a feminist, for God's sake. It's terrible. It doesn't make any sense." It's not terrible, and it makes perfect sense. Since women are equally poisoned by our culture's standards of manhood, we panic when men venture out of their cages. Our panic shames them right back in. So we must decide whether we want our partners, our brothers, our sons to be strong and alone or free and held. Perhaps part of a woman's freeing herself is freeing her partner, her father, her brother, and her son. When our men and boys cry, let's not say to them with our words or energy, "Don't cry, honey." Let's get comfortable allowing our men to gently and consistently express the pain of being human so that violent release isn't their go-to option. Let's embrace our strength so our men can take their turn being soft. Let us, men, women, and all those in between or beyond, reclaim our full humanity. Talks. When Tish was 9, she and I went to our favorite bookstore together. As we walked inside, Tish stopped and stared at a magazine rack, a wall of cover models, each blonder, thinner, and more vacant than the last, all ghosts and dolls. Tish stared. As usual, I was tempted to distract her, hurry her along, put it all behind us. But these messages cannot be put behind us because they are everywhere. Either we leave our kids alone to make sense of them or we wade in with them. I put my arm around Tish and we quietly looked at the covers together for a moment. Me. Interesting, isn't it? What story are they telling you about what it means to be a woman? Tish. I guess that women are very skinny and blonde and have white, pale skin and wear a lot of makeup and tall shoes and barely any clothes. Me. What do you think about that story? Look around this store. Do the women in the store match the idea about women these magazines are selling? Tish looked around. A gray-haired employee was straightening books near us. A Latina woman was flipping through a paperback on the memoir table. A very pregnant woman with blue, punky hair was wrangling with a cookie-eating toddler. Tish. No, not at all. We drove home and Tish disappeared into her room. 15 minutes later, she opened her door and yelled down the stairs, "Mom, how do you spell petition?" I Googled it. Hard word. A little while later, she came downstairs to the kitchen holding a handmade poster. She cleared her throat and began to read. "Help save humanity. Dear world, this is a petition to show that I, Tish Melton, strongly feel that magazines should not show beauty is most important on the outside. It is not. I think magazines should show girls who are strong, kind, brave, thoughtful, unique, and show women of all different types of hair and bodies. All women should be treated equally." I liked her idea so much. It wasn't enough for women to have equality with men. They needed equality with each other. I cannot rid my children's heir of all the lies they'll be told about what it means to become a real woman or man. But I can teach them how to be critics of the culture instead of blind consumers of it. I can train my children to detect those lies and get angry instead of swallowing them and getting sick. 12-year-old me. That's the truth about women. I will match it. 12-year-old Tish. That's a lie about women. I will challenge it. Tish. Chase wants me to join the same club he joined in middle school. I don't want to. Me. So don't. Tish. But I don't want to disappoint him. Me. Listen. Every time you're given a choice between disappointing someone else and disappointing yourself, your duty is to disappoint that someone else. Your job throughout your entire life is to disappoint as many people as necessary in order to avoid disappointing yourself. Tish. Even you? Me. Especially me. 8-year-old Tish. Carrie doesn't like me. 38-year-old me. Why not? What happened? What can we do to make it better? 12-year-old Tish. Sarah doesn't like me. 42-year-old me. Okay, just a fact, not a problem. 12-year-old Tish. Totally. Woods. My friend Mimi told me that she was concerned because her middle school son was spending hours on his phone behind his locked bedroom door. Do you think he's watching porn? I asked her. No, Mimi said. He can't be. He's so young. I just read that the average age kids discover porn is 11. Jesus, Mimi shook her head. I just feel bad spying on him. I mean, it's his phone. Nah. You pay the bill. It's your phone. He's borrowing it. I'm afraid of what I'll find, Mimi said. I know. Me too. Every time, I admitted. But what if he's already found porn? What if he's lost in that world by now? Don't you want to go in and find him? I just have no idea what I'd say. Listen, I know plenty of adults who find certain kinds of porn to be liberating. But the porn kids come across on the internet is misogynistic poison. We have to explain that to them so they don't learn that sex is about violence. I just think that saying anything at all, even if we say it awkward and stumbling and afraid while our kids roll their eyes, is better than saying nothing at all. What if you said, sex is an exciting and wonderful thing about being human. It is natural to be curious about sex, and when we are curious about things, we turn to the internet for information. But here's the problem with using the internet to learn about sex. You cannot know who is doing the teaching. There are people who have taken sex and sucked all the life out of it to package it and sell it on the internet. What they're selling is not real sex. It lacks connection, respect, and vulnerability, which is what makes sex sexy. This kind of porn is sold by people who are like drug dealers. They sell a product that fills people with a rush that feels like joy for a short while, but then becomes a killer of real joy. Over time, people prefer the rush of drugs to the real joy of life. Many who start watching porn very young will get hooked on the rush. Eventually, they will find it hard to enjoy real sex with real human beings. Trying to learn about sex from porn is like trying to learn about the mountains by sniffing one of those air fresheners they sell at the gas station. When you finally get to the real mountains and breathe in that pure wild air, you might be confused. You might wish it smelled like that fake, manufactured air freshener version. We don't want you to stay away from porn while you're young because sex is bad. We want you to stay away from porn because real sex with humanity and vulnerability and love is indescribably good. We don't want fake sex ruining real sex for you. What if you said something like that? I asked Mimi. Do not leave that sweet boy alone in the woods because you are too afraid to go get him. We don't have to have answers for our children. We just have to be brave enough to trek into the woods and ask tough questions with them. We can do hard things. Cream cheeses. Last month, I opened my inbox and saw an email with the subject line, "Mom, you're up." The email was meant to inform me that it was my turn to provide breakfast for my kids' school athletic team after their early morning practice. Each morning, a parent delivers a full spread of bagels, cream cheese, juices, and bananas to school. She sets up the buffet while the children practice so that after they finish, they can dine. The night before I was to deliver the goods, I received another email from the mother of one of the athletes. She had a concern she wanted to share with me. She was worried that the other parents had not been providing sufficient cream cheese choices for the children. For example, last Friday there had been only two options, and several of the children hadn't liked either one of them and had been forced to eat their bagels cream cheeseless. She had a solution. There's a bagel store close to the school that makes five different flavors of cream cheese. Might you be able to provide all of them? All of them. Five flavors of cream cheese. Five flavors of cream cheese is not how to make a child feel loved. Five flavors of cream cheese is how to make a child an asshole. And yet, I am a cream cheese parent. All of my friends are cream cheese parents. Cream cheese parenting is a result of following our memo. Successful parenting is giving your children the best of everything. We are cream cheese parents because we haven't stopped to ask, does having the best of everything make the best people? What if we revised our memo? What if we decided that successful parenting includes working to make sure that all kids have enough, not just that the particular kids assigned to us have everything? What if we used our mothering love less like a laser, burning holes into the children assigned to us, and more like the sun, making sure all kids are warm? Bases. One morning, I woke up and read a story unfolding at our southern border. Children as young as 4 months old were being stripped away from their asylum-seeking parents' arms, loaded into vans, and sent without explanation to detention centers. I searched the web for Americans' reactions to this, certain that all would be as heartbroken and outraged as I was. Some were. Others were hardened. Again and again, I read, "It's unfortunate, but they shouldn't have come here if they didn't want this to happen." Privilege is being born on third base. Ignorant privilege is thinking you're there because you hit a triple. Malicious privilege is complaining that those starving outside the ballpark aren't waiting patiently enough. Despair is physical for me. With each new heartbreaking image and heartless response, I felt hope drain from my body. Hope is energy. That morning, I ran out of both. I shut down my computer and climbed into bed at 3 p.m. Abby tucked me in, kissed my forehead. Out in the hallway, I heard my daughter ask, "Is Mommy okay?" Abby said, "She will be. She's feeling it all now. She has to feel it all so she can use it. Just wait. Let Mom sleep. When she gets up, something amazing will happen." What if we let ourselves feel it all? What if we decided that it is strength, not weakness, to let other people's pain pierce us? What if we stopped our lives and the world for things that are worth stopping for? What if we raised our hands and asked, "Can we stay here for a minute? I'm not ready to run out to recess yet." I slept for 12 hours and then woke up at 3 a.m., on fire. By the time Abby walked out of our bedroom, I'd set up a command center in the dining room. As soon as she saw my face, the piles of papers and the easel covered with phone numbers and ideas, she understood. She looked at me and said, "Okay, babe, let's do this. First, though, coffee." As soon as the sun rose, we called the Together Rising team, my sister, Allison, and Liz. One was on vacation, one in the middle of a big project at work, one caring for a sick relative. They stopped their worlds and set up their own command centers in the beach rental, in the office, in the hospital room. We began the way we always begin our responses to large humanitarian crises. We contacted the people on the ground who understood the crisis firsthand and knew which organizations were responding with wisdom, efficiency, and integrity. Together Rising exists to turn our collective heartbreak into effective action. We do this by serving as a bridge between two sets of warriors, the everyday warriors across the globe who, in their kitchens and cars and offices, refuse to go numb to crises in distant countries and their own communities, and the boots-on-the-ground warriors who devote their lives to world-healing, life-saving work. With a most frequent donation of just $25, Together Rising has ushered more than $20 million over that bridge from heartbreak to action. At Together Rising, we are not the warriors. We find the warriors. This is crucial work because the most effective teams are often not the large, well-known organizations people tend to give to. The fiercest groups we've worked with have been smaller, scrappy, women-led teams, those already trusted by the affected communities and nimble enough to respond in real time. Our job is to find them, ask what they need to continue their fight, and listen deeply. Then we introduce them to our heartbroken people. Our people give in order to get these warriors the help they need to carry on with their work. So we wrote up the story of the administration's lawless cruelty at the border and the warriors working to end it. We posted it for our community, and other brave, compassionate artists helped share it widely. Within 9 hours, we raised $1 million to reunify families. Within a few weeks, we raised $4.6 million. We spent the next year funding and working alongside other organizations to hold the government accountable and return those children to their parents' arms. One morning, I posted a video of my sister escorting a 6-year-old boy named Ariel back into his family's arms after having been separated from them for 10 months. Ariel's father had brought him to the southern border to lawfully seek asylum. When they arrived, American Border Patrol took Ariel from his father's arms. He begged authorities to just deport them both. All he wanted was his son back. The officials refused. They deported him and sent Ariel into government custody alone. This father had to return to his community plagued by extreme poverty and gang violence and tell his wife that he had lost their son. He and Ariel's mother were losing hope that they would ever see their son again when a team funded by Together Rising found them in Honduras. A month later, the Together Rising team stood on the U.S.-Mexico border for 9 hours with Ariel's father, mother, and sister until the authorities agreed to follow the law, allow the family to present for asylum, and move to reclaim Ariel. 1 week after she crossed the border with his parents, my sister picked Ariel up in Washington, D.C., and drove him to the airport to reunite with his family. Ariel told her that he was afraid because he didn't remember what his mom and dad looked like. When my sister pulled out her phone and showed him a picture, he beamed with joy, recognition, and relief. Minutes later, Ariel sprinted into his parents' arms, ending 10 months of excruciating separation. The video I posted of the airport reunion was haunting, both beautiful and utterly brutal. Reactions of gratitude and rage flooded in. That afternoon, I stood in the hallway of my daughter's school. Another mother approached me and said, "Can we talk?" Her tone made my stomach drop. "Sure," I said. We stepped outside. She began, "I've been following you for a long while, but I unfollowed you today." I said, "Okay, sounds like you made the right choice for you." I began to step away. Nevertheless, she persisted. "With all due respect, I have to ask, why don't you care about protecting America as much as you care about protecting illegals? We follow the law, so should they. You know, I read that many of these parents know their kids could be taken from them. They know it, and they come anyway. I'm sorry, but I look at my daughter, and I just think, I cannot imagine doing that. I cannot imagine." I looked at her and thought, "Really? You can't imagine risking it all, doing whatever it takes, to give your child a chance at safety, hope, and a future? Perhaps you're not as brave as these parents are." People use one of two tones when they say the words, "I cannot imagine." The first tone is one of humility, awe, softness, gratitude. There is a quietness about it. A "there but for the grace of God go I" quality. The second tone, the tone this woman used, is different. It is one of dismissal and judgment. There is a definitiveness about it. A "well, I would never" quality. We invoke that tone like a spell, like a clove of garlic around our neck worn to distance ourselves from a particular horror in case it's contagious. We look for a reason, for someone to blame, so that we can reassure ourselves that this horror could never, will never happen to us. Our judgment is self-protection. It's a cage we put around ourselves. We hope it will keep danger out, but it only keeps tenderness and empathy from coming in. What I realized right there in the hallway is that when people use the first tone, it is because they already are imagining. They are using their imagination as a bridge between their known experience and the unknown experience. They are imagining themselves into the other human being's shoes. And that is making them tender, because they can somehow, through the magical leap of imagination, see and feel what the other might see and feel. That's when I realized that imagination is not just the catalyst of art, it's also the catalyst of compassion. Imagination is the